Well, good morning to one and all. One storm down and two more to go this week, huh? So fasten your seatbelt. One of them you may need a boat for, and the other a sled. So things can change quickly. Well, Isaiah 22, we read through it last week. And I said I had some more materials I wanted to present to you on it. I know it's been a week, and so there's chances it's not still on your mind. So I'm going to read quickly through. It's mostly this first section of the prophecy here that I want to look at a little further. He terms it the burden of the valley of vision. And we noted last week that's a way of referring, in this case, to Jerusalem. It's not a typical way of referring to Jerusalem, but we realize from what he says that that's what he's referring to. He says, "What aileth thee now that thou art gone up to the rooftops? Thou art full of stirs, a tumultuous city, a joyous city. Thy slain men are not slain with the sword, nor dead in battle. All thy rulers are fled together. They are bound by the archers. All that are found in thee are bound together, which have fled from far. Therefore said I look away from me. I will weep bitterly. Labor not to comfort me because of the spoiling of the daughter of my people. For it is a day of trouble and of treading down and of perplexity by the Lord God of hosts in the valley of vision, breaking down the walls and of crying to the mountains. And Elam bare the quiver with chariots of men and horsemen, and Kir uncovered the shield. And it shall come to pass that thy choicest valleys shall be full of chariots, and the horsemen shall set themselves in array at the gate. And he discovered the covering of Judah, and thou didst look in that day to the armor of the house of the forest. You have seen also the breaches of the city of David, that they are many, and you gathered together the waters of the lower pool. And you have numbered the houses of Jerusalem, and the houses have you broken down to fortify the wall. You made also a ditch between the two walls for the water of the old pool. But you have not looked unto the maker thereof, neither had respect unto him that fashioned it long ago. And in that day did the Lord God of hosts call to weeping and to mourning and to baldness and to girding with sackcloth. And behold, joy and gladness, slain oxen and killing sheep, eating flesh and drinking wine. Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we shall die. And it was revealed to mine ears by the Lord of hosts, surely this iniquity shall not be purged from you till you die, saith the Lord God of hosts." Okay, so if you were reading this in the ancient Hebrew, it would have a structure that is perhaps a little more difficult to recognize in the English. It seems like it's kind of disjointed. It's not the kind of piece of composition you would like to see in a student who is taking English comp. Seems to jump around a lot. And yet, there is a certain beauty to it in its original form, and a fashion of communication which gives these little snippets of word pictures. He starts out with complaining about the joy that's being expressed in the city. And that gets revisited here at the end with this verse 13. Behold, joy and gladness. Eat, drink, for tomorrow we die. And then he contrasts that joy with the great sorrow that he feels because he has seen the revelation of what is coming to the city. So I'm going to read a little bit here from Alec, and then I have some pictures for you this morning. So this is a special edition. Don't always have pictures in Sunday school. I don't have pictures of Isaiah, but
that's probably good.
Yeah, probably is. Enlarge the thing a little bit.
Now, if you could just speak a little louder. Wave your hand a little bit.
And eventually, we'll just have the pictures.
You know, I really am going to need a technical assistant to present all this stuff in a way that you guys can see it. I can see that now. Anyway, thank you for your help there. I'd like for it to be as visible as possible.
If you can click off of it, it won't be blue.
You know, what we need really is a screen for everybody so they can make their own adjustments, personalize. Okay, very good. So he says three oracles are brought together in chapter 22. First of all, Jerusalem, Shebna, and then Eliakim. They have a common theme in the combination of a this-worldly security. Thus, Jerusalem is found cannibalizing itself to make itself safe. And in this case, he doesn't mean they're actually eating one another up, although there were times in history where that happened, but rather they're breaking down the houses in order to build walls. So cannibalizing in that sense. Without a thought of looking to the Lord, Shebna is portrayed as the man concerned only for his own worldly glory before and after death. Remember last week we read about him building a great tomb for himself. And Eliakim is at risk of becoming the focal point of the security of others to his own in their downfall. When the city, the man, and the family become self-sufficient, they have committed the unpardonable sin for Isaiah. The self-sufficient city. The verses we just read. The interpretation of this section hinges on the way we understand the Hebrew perfect tenses of verses 3 through 7. Okay, so if you're reading this passage for the first time, studying it, you're maybe asking the question, well, what is Isaiah talking about? And one thing that, in terms of history, and one thing that you do when you're analyzing literature is you look at the language. Does he seem to be talking about things which are past or things which are future to himself? And so the tenses of verbs are the way we usually show time. If something has been done, then it's not necessarily true that it will be done. Those are different tenses, the future versus the past. Well, in some languages, we call certain forms of words or verbs tenses, but they don't so much show time as they do some other aspect of action. And he says the Hebrew perfect tenses here can show a type of action as opposed to a time of action. And so that's what he's going to look at in his analysis of this, whether Isaiah is using these perfects to show things that have already been done or to show things that are so certain to be done that it is as though they are in his mind. They're absolutely sure. God has established it, has dictated it, and so therefore it is a sure thing. So some commentators make the verses here look to a time in the past in which Sennacherib, the Assyrian leader, had come and gone, and even though there had been humiliation and loss, the lifting of the threat provoked an outburst of joy. So what's the source of the joy that Isaiah is complaining about? Some would say, well, look, Sennacherib came and surrounded the city, and it appeared that there was going to be a long siege, and they woke up the next morning, and lo and behold, the army was dead and Sennacherib was gone. That'd be a cause for joy, right? And so maybe that's what he's talking about. That would be looking to the past in Isaiah's view. This view, he says, has a commendable simplicity, but at the same time, it is questionable if this could have been the tone of Isaiah's ministry following what he knew to have been a signal act of divine deliverance. He might well have discerned an element of hollowness in the national joy, but the evidence of chapter 37, which we haven't read yet, suggests that he would have capitalized on the situation, not so much by underlining the sin of self-sufficiency as by laboring to show how faith had been justified. Look what God has done, and how reliance on the Lord evaporated the threat. Another, although smaller, objection is that there is no evidence that rulers evacuated the city under Sennacherib's pressures. So if remember the verses that we just read, it speaks of a loss of leadership, of people leaving, giving up without a fight. A slightly different view, held by a couple other commentators, looks back to a moment when Sennacherib appeared to accept Hezekiah's gold and to lift the threat against Jerusalem, reported in 2 Kings chapter 18. We do not know what period intervened before Assyria treacherously renewed pressure on Jerusalem, but it's easy to believe that the apparent escape from danger was the occasion of citywide rejoicing. Against this, Isaiah asks what there is to rejoice over when people die in siege conditions and deserters are captured without resisting. Rather, they should be aware of divine hostility as they see walls battered down and so forth. This solution, too, is broadly persuasive. You probably catch that he doesn't think this is the case either. The occasion cannot be faulted. At that point, their gold having turned Assyria away, their jollity was nothing Isaiah could approve, glee rather than joy, giving glory to human endeavor and resources. So far, so good. But the details are more recalcitrant. First, it is unlikely that Jerusalem was under siege long enough for the full rigor of siege conditions to have been felt. In fact, was Jerusalem strictly under siege at all during this episode, or just under threat? And again, there is no other record of leadership defection, such as described in verse 3. Furthermore, how could the Assyrian forces be represented by Elam in verse 6, which throughout this period was Babylon's ally against Assyria? We must look at the verses again. According to verses 1 through 4, there is a contrast between people and prophet. They rejoice, he weeps. This is because he sees what they do not see: death, defection, and capture. In fact, nothing less than the destruction of the daughter of my people. Verse 5 adds the further explanation that this is a special day of the Lord. Are we to believe that such a day had come and gone without the populace noticing it? Is not Isaiah in principle saying, if you could see what I see coming, there would be no rejoicing? Okay, so what is the commentator working on throughout this? What is he trying to demonstrate for us? What question is he trying to answer?
What episode this applies to?
And more specifically about the language being used by Isaiah. Mm-hmm. Whether these perfect tenses refer to past or to the certainty of the future.
So isn't that what he means by episode? Which episode?
Well, it's a different issue. It's a focus on language versus a... Yes, it is true that he wants to know what episode, but what he's trying to figure out is, should we take this language as future completed with certainty, sort of? I mean, future, but so certain we act like it's done, or past.
Okay.
So that does determine the episode. But as a commentator, what he's grappling with is, okay, how do I take this language? Which way do I go with it? Such a forward view makes the reference to Elam intelligible. So if it's in the future, then it's understandable why Isaiah refers to Elam in this sequence. He wouldn't have in the past. Isaiah has long known that Jerusalem would fall to some foe, though not to Assyria. It was revealed to him at the time of the Babylonian visit that Babylon would be the destroyer. This truth is here veiled by referring to Babylon's remoter ally, Elam, and to the unidentifiable cur. Consequently, the perfect tenses of verses 3 through 7 must be prophetic perfects. The certainty of the already decided acts of God. The moment of thought is from... the movement of thought is from present joy to coming sorrows, and then from past actions to present joy and its consequences. So that's kind of an outline that he sees in this section. The message of the whole is solemn, that past decisions mold future experiences. The unforgivable sin is to believe that if one cannot save oneself, one cannot be saved, and to act as though this world were all. The one situation that matches this oracle is that Jerusalem was in festive mood to celebrate the inauguration of Hezekiah's tunnel. This was to them the crowning guarantee of a self-wrought security, and to Isaiah, the unforgivable sin.
You mean the tunnel itself?
There is, of course, no other evidence of such a festival day, but the decidedly understated way in which 2 Kings 20:20 and 2 Chronicles 32:30 allude to what was in fact an engineering marvel suggests that they would not have wished to record such a day, and that they too concurred with Isaiah's attitude. So in 2 Kings 20, here's the mention of Hezekiah's tunnel. And the rest of the acts of Hezekiah and all his might, and how he made a pool and a conduit and brought water into the city, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? And Hezekiah slept with his fathers, and Manasseh his son reigned in his stead. That's kind of an understatement of a pretty significant achievement. In 2 Chronicles 32, this same Hezekiah also stopped the upper water course of Gihon and brought it straight down to the west side of the city of David. And Hezekiah prospered in all his works. So, yeah, that was sort of an understatement. Okay, what about this tunnel of Hezekiah? Well, you've probably heard somewhat about it. We've already seen in Isaiah that the leaders of the city of Jerusalem were concerned about the water supply. And in any fortified city, one of the obstacles that you always had was water. If you want a fortified city, it's best to put it high up. You want to be above your attackers, so you want it on a hill, if possible. And you want high walls, if possible. But high walls and hills are not really conducive to water, right? Water runs downhill, usually. And so, quite often, there was a problem with that. In some cities, you dug very deep wells and found water. Jerusalem had a wonderful spring, which in the time of Hezekiah was just outside the wall. And so, that's not a good place. And so, what he did was to dig a tunnel, because the city was on a hill, through the limestone, solid rock, so that the water could flow to an area that was slightly lower but inside the city and protected then by the walls. And then he put a wall around the spring and towers so that it was protected as well. And so this is where the pictures come in. And hopefully they'll be the right size. Look at that. This is a sketch of the city of Jerusalem. So you have the Temple Mount here. And there, the valley, the Kidron Valley is over here. Where's my mouse? There we are. And so this is on a long, narrow ridge that drops in elevation as you go to the bottom of the page, which is to the south. And this southern section is what we now know to be the city of David. We haven't actually known that for all that long. We used to assume that the city of David was underneath the rest of the city, somewhat to the north, but archaeologists have dug up sections of it now and then, and they realize that the so-called the ancient city, when David first conquered it, was to the south, and the Gihon Spring is over here on the side of the hill. And then Hezekiah's tunnel itself was built without lasers, and so it zigzags as it goes from its location to the Siloam Pool. Okay, so the earlier city of David would have approximately been this higher wall, and then Hezekiah built more walls that included a protection for the Gihon Spring. You can actually, in good times, walk through this tunnel of Hezekiah, depending on your dimensions. In places it gets fairly narrow, but all this had been chiseled out by workers, we believe, during the time of Hezekiah. It ends up in this location. The Pool of Siloam is an interesting story by itself, because we read about it in the New Testament. It was the pool recorded in the incident in John, where the blind man was to wash his eyes and received his sight. And we assumed that it was this pool, which was still existent and visible. But in 2004, while fixing some drainage pipe, workers stumbled across another structure, which is now believed to be the actual pool that is referenced in John. It's much larger. Hasn't been totally excavated because part of the property is over this way, is owned by the Greek Orthodox Church, and they won't let them dig there. It is sort of a tough call, you know. Some of us are fascinated with the past, and we like to see, right, how things, what's left of what used to be there. But if it happens to be your backyard or your kitchen, it's a little less of interest to you what's underneath it. You know, it's holding me up, so it's fine. We've seen that much of it. This is an artist's conception of what it might have looked like during the time of Christ. But you can see it's very accessible to walking down into, and probably was a kind of purification bath for those on the way to the temple, a mikveh on a large scale.
So is this someone that would have presumably been troubled occasionally?
Yes. There's another pool. I think it was this one that was troubled. There was one to the north too. You asked me a question that's very specific, and I may have not be remembering.
I think he I think it did call it the pool of
There's Bethesda also. In this particular reference, Jesus had anointed the man's eyes with clay, and he was to wash them off. The troubled waters was the case where the man wasn't able to move very fast, and I don't know. When you get to be 60, certain details just escape you.
I think it's a different pool, and I think we actually found it recently. It was assumed to be a myth for a long time, until they actually dug under what was a Roman barracks at one point, and underneath that, they found the
Bethesda pool.
Bethesda pool. Yeah.
Thank the Lord for folks that aren't 60.
I love history.
Okay. But as I remember, it was farther north of this location. Now, one thing, the whole matter of this tunnel and its rediscovery, it wasn't rediscovered until the 1800s. But they found about 20 feet from the end, and this wasn't found until maybe 20 years later. Some schoolboy, I think, noticed this written on the wall and reported it. There was this inscription on Hezekiah's tunnel. And so if you can, anybody can read that to us, go ahead. But it's in ancient Hebrew, and actually one of the oldest examples of this script that we have. Now, I'll just tell you this. If you go there now, you'll only see a replica because soon after it was found, it was stolen and ended up in a museum in Istanbul. But they've recreated a version of it here. And I can tell you, with the help of translators, what it says. It says, behold the excavation. This is... now, this is the history of the breaking through. While the workmen were still lifting up the pickaxe, each toward his neighbor, and while 3 cubits yet remained to be cut through, each heard the voice of the other calling to his neighbor. For there was an excess in the rock on the right, so probably a crack. And on the day of the breaking through, the excavators struck, each to meet the other, pickaxe against pickaxe, and there flowed the water from the spring to the pool over a space of 1,200 cubits. And part of this is missing. Of a cubit was the height of the rock above the heads of the excavators. So, what a fascinating thing to find in a very old tunnel written in a very old language. An account of that moment whenever the two sides, they apparently were tunneling from both ends.
Just looking at the map of that tunnel, it could have been down there a long time.
Well, there are several false starts along in the excavation. So the total length of the tunnel is about 1,750 feet. So that's about a third of a mile. And it could have been quite a bit shorter if they would have had lasers. But
Keith, do we know any ways that they attempted to orient themselves and dig it? I mean, were there ways that they, other than just, I think we need to go this way, but surely there was some way that they...
Well, one thing that wouldn't have been too difficult was determining how deep to dig, because at least on the Gihon's inside, the water would, if you let it flow a little bit, you could see, is it still going downhill? You know, are we creating a waterfall or are we going uphill? No, it's still about right. I don't know that we have a clue as to how they determined which way to go. I mean, it looks if you like, you know, if it was level ground, you go up on top and you get an idea of which way to go, and you go down below and you just make the tunnel straight, right? You're going to be close. But this is on the side of a hill, and the entrance to this, there was already some excavation that had taken place in previous times that had created a kind of cave. And so there's no way to get your initial direction. At least it's not very easy. I don't think we have any idea how they determined where they were going. And it looks at times like they weren't sure because it does move around.
You just keep trying, I guess.
I guess. But you can see this was a significant achievement. And could likely have been a cause for great rejoicing in the city. Certainly a greater feeling of security. Now, this article here notes that there are always naysayers that re-examine things and decide that, well, maybe Hezekiah didn't build that. The majority opinion is, yeah, this is what's being talked about. Just because the Bible mentions it doesn't mean it's probably not true.
Yeah. Our friend Kevin Moser, if I remember correctly, took a couple guys when they were over there one time and just walked the tunnel. I mean, I guess it's
I don't know about that, but anyway, it is available for perusal. Another connection here then to this section that we're reading. Here's a picture of Hezekiah's so-called broad wall in the northwest part of Jerusalem. Now, it wasn't just in the northwest part. That's just the only place that's been uncovered because people have built on top of it. But they can tell that it was built using materials from houses, which were broken down for that purpose. And in fact, right here in the corner of this picture, where my cursor is, you can see the remnants of the foundation of a house that just got built right over top of. And that seems to be what Isaiah was referring to here in this chapter, this act of cannibalizing houses in order to build this wall of security. One more thing here that will probably be of interest to you, an account by the guy who actually is credited with discovering this tunnel. Now, there's another report that a pilgrim / tourist maybe 30 years earlier had also found it, but Sir George Warren is the one who gets the credit most usually. At the end of October of 1867, so this would have been just after our Civil War, Warren did extensive excavating in Jerusalem. In fact, he is the only one in modern times to have managed to do that, and the last one in modern times, except for the limited excavation that's being done now with regard to the Temple Mount, because the surest way to start a war in the Middle East is to suggest going and digging on the Temple Mount, right? Well, it was still a sensitive issue. It was under the control of the Muslims at his time, the Ottomans. But he was sort of a, I guess you would say, a free spirit. And so, possibly. He went outside the walls of the temple, dug down, and dug toward it, okay? And had some friendly Arab workers and various things that he did. He won a couple of them over by letting them eat his pet lizard. They really apparently like lizards. Some interesting stories out of that time. But he gained access to things that have not had exposure since his time. Discovered a number of huge cisterns underneath the Temple Mount for storing water. Anyway, he and his team explored this man-made conduit. Warren recorded in his journal that In the beginning, it was easy walking until they reached 600 feet into the tunnel. Then they began crawling on all fours. As they saw bits of cabbage stalks floating by, they realized that the waters had started to rise. Okay, and so the spring's output does vary with probably rainfall in other places. And so they got in there, water started to rise. Warren described himself with a pencil, compass, and field book in his hands, and the candle for the most part in his mouth. Okay, this was before NICAD batteries and flashlights. Okay, so you're going to explore this tunnel, you're going to do it with a candle. Yeah. On your hands and knees with a candle in your mouth. At one point, he and his fellow had just 4 inches breathing space. When observing, so I guess you're going like this, but if you're going to look, you got to bring your mouth underwater. His mouth was underwater. At 900 feet into the tunnel, they discovered false turns and began to go in a zigzag direction. It was here that Warren inadvertently swallowed part of his pencil, nearly choking. When they came out shivering, it was dark. They had been nearly 4 hours in the water. So, would you like to be an explorer in the 1800s? I guess so.
It's for certain kinds of people.
Yeah. In another account, here a little bit later on here in this one, he was exploring a shaft earlier in this water system. And in order to see, he lit a piece of magnesium wire. Okay, it puts off a really bright light. And of course, everybody's got magnesium wire in their pocket, right? I guess if you're an explorer, that's something you carry. But just thinking about the efforts of the primitive resources that they had in order to discover this stuff is interesting. And of course, all the digging he did, there were no backhoes or track hoes or anything like that. It was done by hand. And so... he doesn't mention that, but it doesn't seem like to be a terribly good idea, does it?
Probably something to hold it. Holder sticking out.
Wonder if he has singed eyebrows. Yeah.
How old did he live to?
I think I actually read he lived to his 80s.
Wow.
Yeah, he... Yeah, there it is.
How would you? It seems like, I don't know, I'm just going off memory here, but is it hard to put out a magnesium fire?
You can't. It's a Class D fire.
I think it or something.
On board ship in the Navy, if you have a Class D fire, a combustible material, like magnesium is the biggest one. All you can do is shove it off the side of the ship and watch it burn all the way down. The fuel has to be extinguished. No more magnesium, no more fire.
Wow.
Yeah, water doesn't affect it for sure. Yeah.
You could just snuff it out like you would a candle. No.
So you start with a short wire, right?
Cut off a little piece.
And you don't hold it in your mouth. Yep. So, this is a marvel, clearly. Even in our day, we marvel at it. And yet, Isaiah seems to have had a dim view of the whole project.
Well, there's something greater. Mm-hmm. You know, just like the house that got cannibalized for the wall, it is important that your family is protected, but... if you keep your four walls around your family and the whole city is at risk, what good are your four walls? Because then mm-hmm. If the city gets breached, your house will get breached.
Mm-hmm.
But at times, it's more important that the city is protected. You know, that's a higher... So, yeah, it's important to have the, you know, engineering feat of fresh water coming in, but mm-hmm. if you still trust in the wrong thing and your city is overwhelmed, it doesn't matter that you had fresh water.
Yep.
So it's not the what, but it's the why that Isaiah is really getting at.
Well, and it's also the dimension of the divine. So where is God in all this? Mm-hmm. We can look at it from the standpoint of sensible defense and say, yeah, that was a good idea. You know, get the water in where you can have it without the enemy being there. But if in that action you're a part of a grand scheme of God where he says, this is my city, I'll protect this city. If you'll trust in me, I'll take care of you. Then for you to say, yeah, but I feel insecure. I feel like I need to do something else here. Then you're not trusting him. Now, I think it's important for us to note that we can't assume that we're in the same position as Jerusalem and the city and the children of Israel in our own personal endeavors in life. If you don't make sensible, defensive action in your life, that's not because you don't trust God, or because you do trust God, it's because you're presuming. There's no need to say that I'm on God's side, therefore he's on mine, and therefore I'm not going to worry about anything because what happens, happens, and he'll take care of it. Well, I trust him with my eternal future. I trust him with the details of my life in the sense that he sent his son to show me how to live them out. I trust him fully that way. I trust him that the best way to live is in consideration of my neighbor and loving others as myself. But I don't expect him to protect me if I engage in something stupid. That's different.
Mm-hmm. And isn't it true that, at least in my life, it feels like I need to do what I know to do, mm-hmm. and there are times when I can't do anything, and I leave it to him, the outcome. Just, mm-hmm. I remember the fear of when the girls drove off the first time in their cars. That was a new level of trust, that I can't do anything. And so if they perish, then it's in his hands. If there's a place, it's different. After I've done everything I can do, then I just have to rely on his will, whatever the outcome.
And then, too, we approach potential action with the mindset of, Father, what would you have me to do? We look for guidance.
Yes.
You know, we can become totally possessed by security concerns. You know, if you look at the world around us. Hey, we got a supply chain problem. You been to Walmart lately? How many empty shelves there are? We could get possessed by that. We need to store stuff up, you know? We need to find us a cave or something, dig us a nuclear bunker. We got problems here. Well, pray about it. Is you sure that's where God wants you to go? You sure that's where he wants you to lead others? It doesn't seem that we're there, right? That's not, I don't hear any of you saying those things, even though we are concerned about various aspects of the security in this world. Well, Isaiah sees what Hezekiah is doing here as a direct act of mistrusting God. God has already performed in a way to show that he is capable of taking care of the city. Sennacherib's been there before, and it didn't turn out well for him. But now, it's thought that during Hezekiah's time, there was a huge influx of people into Jerusalem because of the fall of the northern kingdom. Samaria fell in about 720, 721. And so there was an influx of Israelites into Jerusalem, and so they occupied a big part of the area which wasn't walled in. And so Hezekiah then proceeded to wall in a much greater area, protect the water supply, And the city still fell some years later, but nevertheless.
The importance of having all the accounts of the Old Testament is the pattern that emerges is not that God does everything the same way every time. The pattern is that he is concerned with the individual growing and developing, and the individual should trust in God. Mm-hmm. But Israel didn't always take 300 people to battle. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they did, sometimes they took a lot more.
Sure.
The important thing was that they trusted God. So it would be really nice if everything always happened the same way. Mm-hmm. We could just count on that, but then we'd be counting on that and not on God.
That's right. That's true. So in the last moments here, let me just sum up this chapter, not sum it up, but complete it by reading here the account from 2 Kings of when the city did fall. And it came to pass, this is 2 Kings 25, and it came to pass in the ninth year of his reign, in the 10th month, in the 10th day of the month, that Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came, he and all his hosts, against Jerusalem, and pitched against it, and they built forts against it all around. And the city was besieged until the 11th year of King Zedekiah. And on the ninth day of the fourth month, the famine prevailed in the city. It had plenty of water. And there was no bread for the people of the land. And the city was broken up. And this is particularly the phrase that I wanted to read to you. And all the men of war fled by night by the way of the gate between the two walls, which is by the king's garden. Okay, so Isaiah here pictures this essential laying down of arms, this abandonment of the city by its leadership. And it's recorded here in 2 Kings 25. So, no wonder he lamented and mourned the coming time. And how incongruous the joy that they were expressing appeared to him, knowing what would come. All right, thank you.
Amen. I think we all understand that a good definition of love is doing what is in the best interest of someone else, caring about them. But I think it also is about how connected we are to something or someone. And so I find in my life, I have found that when I react to something in a way that is not Christ-like, it's probably because I'm attached to something in that area more than I am attached to God's view of that area. And that's easy to do. It's, you know, we grow up and you kind of react like your family does in different ways. And sometimes that's good and sometimes that's not so good. And so it is a process your whole life of kind of attaching yourself, with detaching yourself first from the wrong thing, and then attaching yourself to Christ. And that is how I have found I grow to love him more. And it's a process that we all have to go through, no matter how well we were parented, or even as a parent, thinking, I don't want the first attachment to be to me. Even though that kind of has to be at first so that we can point them to Christ, I want them to love me less so that they can love Christ more, because I have found, and I found this especially true in marriage, that if I love Christ first, I'll love someone else best. And we can't truly love well until that first love is to Christ. So my prayer is that I will love him more and more, that I will seek out and find the areas of my life that maybe I don't love him best in, and continue to learn to love him more.